The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist.
You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Today I'm going to do something that I've wanted to do for a long time, but because of its length, I really can't do it in any great detail. I want to eventually write a book, or at least a lengthy article, on the political theory of the Russian Orthodox Church under the Patriarchate. That is to say, the general mentality and philosophical point of view of the patriarchs of Russia, starting with St. Job under Boris Godunov, all the way to the last patriarch under Tsar Peter, Adrian the First. Today I'm just going to do the last two, which to me, number one, is largely not dealt with in English, and number two, not very well known even amongst people who spend a lot of time on the Russian Church. For those of you who don't know, I am a Russian Orthodox philosopher. For the last 20 years, I've specialized in the history of social and political thought, and my general approach, and you could see this through all of the shows that I've done over the last few years, is neo-patristic and Platonic, and that is applied to both Russian and Ukrainian national movements. And I have the eccentric position that Ukraine and Russia are two equal independent cultures that, rather than fighting each other, should be cooperating with one another. The Ukrainians have to drop their anti-Russian rhetoric, and the Russians, for their part, have to drop this concept that Ukrainians are just West Russians. That was Gogol's point of view, and that's my point of view. We're going to deal today with the last two patriarchs of Moscow. And what a lot of people don't realize is the far-reaching consequence of Peter the Great's banning and crushing of the patriarchate in 1700, the death of the last patriarch, Adrian, until the patriarch was restored after World War I. Peter the Great, in my personal opinion, is not a legitimate czar, and much of the 18th century royals in Russia were illegitimate. Peter the Great was a Freemason. Peter the Great was a demonist, and even in some of the more sympathetic biographies, they go into some detail as to his black masses, the Holy Drunken Synod, where they would dress in clerical robes and mock the church and things like that. Peter the Great, as I've argued many times in the past, is one of the reasons that the Old Believer movement, though I'm not an Old Believer, but I've always been very sympathetic to the Old Believers in general, one of the reasons they developed into such a large movement, maybe 25 million people by 1800, was because of the condition of the church in the 18th century. The 18th century was an era of enlightenment, and what that really means is state centralization and the ideology of materialism. And this is something that Peter the Great manifests more than anyone. And he doesn't deserve the title of the Great, in that he is Peter the Apostate, as far as I'm concerned. The last two patriarchs have a tendency to confirm this. Joachim, who dies in 1690, and Adrian, who dies in 1700, the latter was relatively anti-Petrian and saw the influence of Western Europe to be corrosive, and Adrian's own position is one of the reasons why Peter had suppressed the Patriarchate. When Peter suppressed the Patriarchate 1700, 1701, he brought the church under the control of the state, at least in the sense that there was a standing synod that was overseen in financial matters by a procurator who was appointed by the Tsar or the Emperor. The church at the local level lost all of its democratic privileges, lost its corporate status, and essentially became an appendage to the state. Now, there's a lot of writers out there who are challenging this view now, that the church and its missionary work in Asia and in Alaska show a tremendous amount of energy, and that's true. But Peter and his successors purged the church, destroyed hundreds of monasteries, consolidated thousands of parishes. And so by the time Alexander I becomes emperor in the beginning of the 19th century, the church is an institution that lacks a great degree of respect. The old believers had grown to huge numbers and were on again, off again persecuted by the state. Russian historians, and especially those who are Slavophiles and who are Russian nationalists of a sort, have yet to effectively deal with the canonical position of the church once the state took it over, and taking it over by the suppression of the patriarch. Now, there is only one emperor rather than the dual ruling system that you had, the patriarch overseeing the social life of the nation, the Tsar seeing the political and financial life of the nation. For the most part, the Russian patriarchs have been very talented. They have been strong centralizers, and they have been concerned with one thing. And this group of patriarchs, from Job to Adrian, it's education, the printing of books, and the building up of both parish and monastic schools. One area of research that has not been dealt with, at least to my satisfaction, is the tremendous increase in money spent by the patriarch, prior to Adrian, of course, on the development of a web of educational institutions, both at the larger parishes, cathedral sites, and the monasteries. And Peter did quite a bit of damage to that in secularizing at least much of the monastic lands. It was totally secularized under Catherine II, also known as Catherine the Great. So we're going to deal with these two patriarchs, Joachim and Adrian. They don't get lots of scholarly attention. The only reason that Adrian gets talked about at all is because he was the last patriarch. But both of these men are extremely pious and educated. The old mythology of the Russian church being ignorant and everything else, it's largely been put to rest by most of the scholarly work in the field. Hawk and Fries and others have largely buried that old mythology. However, it is true that these two patriarchs have to deal with the fact that about half of their believers have defected to the old believer, old ritualist movement. Russian historians have to take that seriously. The most monarchist, nationalist faction of the church had left the official patriarchate and formed their old believer hierarchy, which, up at least for a while, was located in Austria-Hungary. So the patriarchs after Nikon, who ruled at the same time Alexis ruled the state, are dealing with a much smaller organization. They're dealing with what they would call sectarians. I do believe that the old believers were Orthodox people to the extent that they had a priesthood. Some of the old believers had priests, some of them rejected it. But those who had priests, which were concentrated in the Cossack regions of the south, they usually had priests and bishops, which were granted them from the Patriarch of Constantinople. Eventually, the Russian government put pressure on Austria to eliminate the old believer hierarchy in Bela Klenica, or the White Well, and there's a bishop there today. So after Nikon, who's ruling in the 1660s, where the old believer movement became officially anathematized, and of course they anathematized each other, and that's for another show. I'm not going to get into that here, although I do have a book out on the old believers, which you can get on my program page here at the Voice of Reason. Before I continue, though, I would like to announce that I am now more or less a part of an institution called the Sherman Institute. You search for it online. It is an educational think tank developing it into a guild of university professors and experts who are part of this kind of paleo-conservative and agrarian nationalist movement. And I want you to check it out. I'm going to be teaching a few classes there. As of right now, today is June 11th, 2012. I don't know what I'm going to be teaching there yet, but I have been dealing with those guys, and while we disagree very much theologically, we do not politically, and I have a great amount of respect to that group of people. So please check out the Sherman Institute. I will be teaching a couple of classes there. They'll be online classes, and if there's any interest in working under me and some of these topics that the Sherman Institute deals with, please email me and let me know, and then we can organize something on the Sherman Institute website, where then classes are being held in a virtual environment. And then once you get to the Sherman Institute and you have to make your own account and everything else, you could begin working with some of the scholars who are in residence in this virtual professors' guild. And I have a lot of respect for those guys, and I found out about them from the American Free Press, where I used to work years ago, back when it was a spotlight. And I was very impressed. The fact is that what they're doing now is creating a alternative educational environment so as to deepen our knowledge in the great books of the Western tradition. And I respect that very, very much. I will update you guys on that later on. If you have any questions on that, you can either contact them or contact me in the meantime. Anyway. Patriarch Joachim, he dies in 1690, the penultimate patriarch of the Russian Church prior to 1918. I also need to answer this question, too. The current patriarch of Moscow, Joseph Stalin, resurrected the patriarchate in 1944 in the midst of the war against Germany. It was his pet. It was his creation. And they were sort of useful idiots going along with the Soviet system and ideologically backing the Soviet system. I don't believe that the Patriarchate, which was created by Stalin, is in fact a legitimate religious institution. It is fraudulent. However, despite their uncanonical, nasty origins, they do have many good people who are struggling under their protection. They have canonized the royal family, and they have canonized the new martyrs, those who were killed by the Soviet state, even though these people, decades ago, were handing over the whereabouts of catacomb Orthodox people and refusing to pray for the souls of those Orthodox killed by Soviet Secret Service. I don't want to spend any time on this, but I make a distinction between a group of bishops who may or may not be legitimate and the masses under them who are good Christians. The mere fact that your bishops are fraudulent doesn't automatically mean that you as an individual in your parish is somehow cut off. That's simply not how it works. And I've also dealt with that at some length on this show. So for those of you who are wondering, I don't believe that this 1944 patriarch is legitimate. Although, at the same time, they have good people, and they have done things, such as the canonizations, that have tried to reach out to others. So I can respect that all these years after the fact. So mutual forgiveness may be in order. They do have good people under them, however, so I do not judge them. I could only tell you the facts as to where they came from and what their activities were under the Soviet system. Okay, again, Patriarch Joachim, Patriarch Adrian. Patriarch Joachim, when Peter the Great was a young man, supported him. He wanted a strong state, and the fact is that both Adrian and Joachim were strong royal centralizers. That has a lot to do with their desire to spread education and printing. It also has a lot to do with their doing battle against the so-called sectarians. Patriarch Joachim wrote his Spiritual Testament, which is essentially his last will, in 1690. The patriarch from Job to Adrian had a lot in common. Number one, they were all very strong men. Number two, they were anti-Western in the sense that the religious and philosophical point of view of Western Europe was corrosive and hostile to the Russian idea. Number three, all they really thought about was education and book printing. Number four, they believed in central authority. Russia is surrounded by enemies, and therefore the state needs to centralize, the church needs to centralize. This is an emergency measure because Russia is surrounded by opponents. And all of the patriarchs of this era, what we call, generally speaking, medieval or early modern Russia, were identical in those general philosophical points of view. They were educated, they were pious, and the time of troubles in Russian history brought many Russian writers into contact with Roman Catholic Poles for the first time. When Peter the Great was a young man, he often would hang around the German quarter in Moscow and learn Western European ways. And the church overwhelmingly in Russia, not so much Ukraine, which is a different story. The Ukrainian church is actually going out of existence at this point in time, coming under the control of Moscow, which is a huge problem, since that was not done according to the canonical procedure. The so-called Kievan metropolitan under Moscow is not legitimate either, although for a different set of reasons. The Russian government, in essence, this time, the very time we're talking about now, had bribed the Patriarch of Constantinople with quite a bit of money and Russia's big export fur and skin to sell the Kievan church to Moscow. In no way can that be justified canonically. And so, you know, we have more trouble on top of more trouble in trying to deal with the canonical and philosophical concepts here. So Joachim's Spiritual Testament is focused largely on centralizing power. Russia is the Third Rome. Russia is the New Jerusalem. Russia is the New Israel in the Old Testament sense. And we are the Levites. We must centralize power as much as possible for the sake of defending our nation, church, and cultural tradition. Both Joachim and Adrian were very anti-Western in that sense. They saw the West as growing in corruption and bureaucracy and the very beginnings of capitalism and the growth of the British Empire as something that was not lost on the Russian church at the time. Joachim believed in a very strong role for the state. He believed that the state is the main guardian of the church. It doesn't govern the church, but it guards and protects the church in its role in society. Joachim, more so than Adrian, and possibly more so than any other patriarch, did believe in a procedural sense that the Tsar is the head of the church. Not in an episcopal sense, of course, the patriarch is, but that the Tsar has as his primary concern the protection of church property, church valuables, monastic land, and all the rest of it. Now he's going to eat that words when Peter, those words when Peter will begin to secularize monastic property. But you got to remember something. At this time, political theory didn't revolve around how to improve people. Improving people was done at the local level, in the family, in the parish, in the religious context. There was no concept of progress in the modern sense. The state maintained basic equilibrium among classes. The state maintained estates as they are, with their specific rewards and duties, and it never went beyond that. In my Third Rome book, I make the point over and over again that you can't use the word political in our sense in 2012 as you can in Russia in 1600. What was considered political then is very different than what we consider it now. There was no concept of progress. There was this basic equilibrium among classes. For Joachim, the main role of the Tsar was the protection of the church and the nation, and also to maintain a strong hand in terms of church order. Now, because the old believers by this time had grown so large, and many, many villages had left the official church and went into an equally orthodox but far stricter old ritualist movement, centralization, in this case, has as much to do with marshaling resources against the old believers as anything else. And this is why this group of patriarchs is obsessed with literacy and education. The Old Believers were always a very literate group of people, and the official church would often lose debates with the Old Believers because of that. And so these patriarchs, who were very literate, wanted to begin printing books, Lives of the Saints, service books, the Psalter, church fathers, especially Isaac of Syria and John Chrysostom, as a way to educate the official church so as to do battle with the sectarians. One of the things that Joachim did to show that he meant business was to kick the Jesuits out of the Russian Empire. He increased the number of administrators, both in the central authority as well as in the local diocese and parishes. He created many new dioceses, partially because he is one of the people involved in this semi-canonical or non-canonical absorption of the Kievan Ukrainian Church. In fact, the treaty signed between the Cossacks and the Moscow government always had a stipulation that our religious tradition, which is a little bit different than what you have in Russia, will remain inviolate. So the Tsar and Patriarch Joachim erred in buying the Kievan Church from Constantinople because it had been under the Greeks for a long time. And so this was non-canonical, and this was improper, and it was immoral, especially since it went against all of the agreements that Moscow had made with the Church of Kiev. That's not to say that there weren't plenty of Ukrainians looking for Russian protection against the Poles or the Turks. There were. If I were alive at the time and living there, I too would look to the Russian Tsar for protection. That did not justify the absorption of Kiev into the Russian Empire and a complete removal of the old aristocracy and the imposition of Russian settlers in the area that then were loyal to Moscow. That's the problem. That's a moral problem. And Russian nationalists, for all the great that the Tsars did, have to take that seriously and have to deal with the historical repercussions of that. Joachim was concerned with the financial status of the clergy. In Imperial Russia, clergymen were not well respected. They tried to be as holy as they could, but they had to work their own fields. They received very little money for their position, and they just were just one peasant out of many. On the one hand, they were just seen as another peasant. On the other hand, at the very least, it wasn't this imposition of some foreign group of people over the parishes. And the respect for the clergy went down when clergymen were appointed by the bishop rather than elected by the people. That was one of the changes that Peter the Great forced on the church, and I think hurt it very much. Okay, we're going to finish with Patriarch Joachim and then go on to Patriarch Adrian as soon as we come back. We're going to take a break right now, so hang in there.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're dealing with the last two patriarchs of old Russia, Joachim and Adrian. And we're dealing with their basic approach to theology and the state. And it's significant for a whole bunch of reasons. Number one, because Adrian was the last patriarch until 1918. Number two, the patriarch had a very specific set of goals and agendas. Number three, they were very literate and very strong in their rule. I mean, there was no weaklings in this position. Russia was very fortunate in that respect. And finally, that they had a lot in common, especially these last two, who wanted to cooperate with the state in eliminating the old believers at the same time as Patriarch Adrian will will say to his chagrin that the church is becoming more and more a college connected to the state rather than an independent unity. Patriarch Adrian will condemn his own powerlessness as he gets older, and then when he dies in 1700, the Russian Patriarch will be a suppressed office, the Holy Synod taking its place. We're finishing up dealing with the mentality of the last two patriarchs, the penultimate patriarch Joachim, who was one of the leaders in the absorption of the Kievan Church and the Cossack Church into Moscow's control. And instead of permitting a sort of ecclesial communion and mutual friendship with the native clergy, the state and church then imposed a Russian-speaking clergy onto the Ukrainian society. Moscow was very promising relative to protecting Ukraine from the Poles and the Turks. At the same time, there were very few churchmen in Ukraine that wanted to be absorbed into the Russian church and hence come under the Tsar. Joachim believed in education. He believed in literacy. Both Joachim and Adrian and their predecessors believed in a strong network of schools. Joachim regularized clergy fees. Clergymen had to make a living. They were very, very poor in general. They had to do a lot of the peasant work themselves. And they were appointed by the bishop and given a very small stipend. So sometimes a priest, in order to make ends meet, had to increase the amount of money he would receive for his services. They didn't like the idea of having to charge money, but they simply needed to make a living and did not have the time to farm land to any great extent. So he regularized these fees and kind of made them standard because he did worry about the low financial estate of the clergy. He appointed more bishops because he wanted more educated Russians to do battle both with Western ideas on the one hand and with the local old believers on the other. Almost all the patriarchs viewed Western Europe as heretical. I mean, they were, religiously speaking, heretical, but this meant that their entire way of life was corrupt. So any attempt to bring Latin, Roman, German ideas into Russia was out of the question. And they were willing to excommunicate whoever was doing this. I mean, even to the point where they rejected the concept of having Russian soldiers fight under foreign generals. This was a relatively common practice. So Joachim, like all his successor as well as his predecessors, rejected the idea that Western Europe has anything to do with the Russian tradition. The Russian tradition is very separate. It is Eurasian. It has a lot to do with the Byzantine Commonwealth and not with the Latin papacy. So the Russian patriarchs over and over and over again condemned any contact with Western European religious bodies. And so there you have, again, one of the many anathematizings of ecumenism and any kind of relations with the Western European religious groups, the Catholics or Protestants, Anglicans, etc. And that was repeated over and over again by the Russian Church right up until the 20th century. Now, Patriarch Adrian, who ruled for 10 years, was the last Russian patriarch prior to World War I, where Tikhon, who we've dealt with on this show, was raised to that rank. And so from 1701 to 1918, there was no Patriarch of Russia. The office was abolished. Adrian had figured out that Peter was willing to do this and was willing to bring the church under state control as much as humanly possible. Now, as I said before, that's been exaggerated over the years. The church did have a substantial amount of independence. The one area that the state did control was their finances. Joachim had expanded the church greatly. Russia was expanding at the time after the Time of Troubles, and he wanted many bishops, educated monastics, who were capable, who was as strong as he was, and this was the case both with Joachim and Adrian, to place their intellectual stamp on their diocese. The fact is that both Joachim and Adrian were anti-Western, but that the West, at least at the time, was becoming more literate and scientific than the East needed to fight back the time of troubles and the Polish occupation of Russia under the pretender. I don't have time to get into that, but there was a point in time during the late Renaissance where the Polish and Swedish army occupied most of Russia after the death of Boris Godunov. And Russians learned quite a bit about Roman Catholicism. Of course, they associated it with the Polish army, and they threw Patriarch Gudmogenes in prison, and forced him to convert, and they killed him. They starved him, actually, because he had refused to convert to the Polish Catholic faith. But that gave a tremendous education to the Russian people and to how they viewed Roman Catholicism. So needless to say, Hermogenes' successors were vehemently anti-Western and anti-ecumenical. But Patriarch Adrian, when Joachim, when Peter was a young man, supported him. Adrian rejected him because Adrian thought that there was something very wrong with Peter mentally. Peter the Great was involved in a sort of a parody of a black mass, the so-called drunken synod that he created, where he would get drunk and they would make fun of all of the church services and dress up in bishop's robes and stuff like that. It was actually really pretty nasty. And Adrian got wind of this and wanted nothing to do with Peter. Adrian's political theory was purely theocratic as a result of this. He got to the point where Peter's behavior was so bizarre and so anti-Christian. I mean, he was brought into the Masonic Lodge in Amsterdam during his great tour of Western Europe. He kind of minimized the role of the Tsar as only to defend the faith. The Tsar is to defend the faith, which means to secure the borders of the empire, where, of course, law and the tradition of the common people was something that was fixed for all time. The Tsar had no right to manipulate how the communes ran, how the diocese ran. This was something that was a following immemorial tradition, going back to the Byzantine Empire, and not something that would be considered political. He believed, like Nikon before him, that the church was higher than the state. The state is to listen to the church, but not the other way around. To put it crudely, I mean, he saw the state as a bodyguard for the church. That is simply an administrative apparatus to defend the society from external or internal enemies, but otherwise really doesn't have a role in the day-to-day life of the Russian Orthodox person. And Nikon and Adrian were the only two patriarchs in Russia's history that went out of their way to make the point that the church is higher than the state and has a right to dictate to the state. Now, needless to say, partially this is because of Adrian's discovery of exactly what kind of a man Peter the Great was. I should also note that both Joachim and Adrian condemned usury. And partially this is because as Russia becomes more and more vulnerable to Western ideas, as the huge commercial empires in London and Amsterdam are developing, the massive economic growth of Western Europe is based to a great extent on the reconstitution of banking power and therefore usury. So usury is one of these things that they associate with Western Europe that they do not want in Russia. And so both Joachim and Adrian officially condemn and anathematize usury. So for those modernist Orthodox, you have to deal with this. I mean, this is the church made its official pronouncements in this and condemned capitalism in its modern form. That's not the same thing as condemning a free market, but capitalism and free market are not only different things, they're opposing things. He was an activist. While it's true that you have to be a monk to become bishop, Adrian was of the belief that Orthodox people, no matter what their rank in society, have the right, in fact, have the obligation to preach the gospel wherever they go, especially when they're coming up against the development of Western capitalism, which really was, it's really what usury meant, was this kind of individualist philosophy developing in places like Amsterdam and London, where money becomes an end in and of itself. This is what they mean when they use the word usury. It's not just taking interest or excessive interest. It's the entire drive that our only purpose is to make a profit. Make a profit always at someone else's expense. This is what they meant by usury. The developing of these overarching dominant banking houses, now that the Italian banking houses have gone out of existence, that black nobility migrated north, regardless of all of that. For them, usury was the domination of the banks that they saw slowly but surely developing in Northern Europe. Now, the church in Northern Russia was regularly at war with Western capitalists, because remember something else, we're in a period of time where there's a massive demand for grain from Russia and Ukraine and the Baltics, and whoever could control this trade in the Baltic region was able to make a lot of money. So the patriarchs, being literate, were well aware of what's happening in the West. And so Adrian's condemnation of usury was a condemnation of this banking oligarchy. And the fact that the British were very interested in using Russia as an overland route to get to India, and this is actually probably a show in and of itself, but Britain saw Russia, even at this early date, as a source for cheap labor and natural resources. But the British also saw Russia as a threat, and that's going to continue straight up until World War I, and it really was a series of accidents concerning the Balkans that got Russia and Britain to fight on the same side. For the most part, the history of Britain relative to Russia is one of constant threat, constant challenge, and constant warfare, at least diplomatically speaking. I have an article, in fact, and I don't know enough about it to do a show on it or write on it, but the 13th Dalai Lama in Tibet had asked Russia to take Tibet under its protection, to keep Tibet away from British, essentially British opium dealers. They would much rather, this is later than this period of time, but I actually have the article, which I could send to anyone who might want it, that the Buddhists in Tibet wanted Russian control so as to keep the British drug dealers out, and the drug dealers also connected with the Sassoon banking family in Paris. So that's a separate issue, but I could send that article to anyone who's interested in it. So condemning usury for him was a catch-all phrase. The whole notion of corporate individualist profiteering is officially anathema because these two patriarchs put their stamp on that. Peter begins, as Adrian gets older, Peter begins to appoint bishops without the synod's permission. This becomes a problem. Adrian will condemn Peter the Great for this. Peter the Great is starting to take the prerogatives of the church to himself. And one of the ways that the church fights back here is not only because of Adrian has a very strong personality, but he also demands the reformation of the courts, because he wants these kind of, really, essentially theft of church property, which Peter the Great is engaging in, and then all the way through the 18th century up until Alexander I, where by then, the beginning of the 19th century, the church is almost completely nationalized. Adrian fights back by demanding a free, fair, independent court system in Russia that is able to adjudicate the demands of the state on the one hand and monastic property and law on the other. Of course, the tradition in Russia is that the church has its own courts. So things, you know, more of, things of a moral nature, like divorce and everything, come under the church courts. That's long gone in Russia, and what's happening now is that Peter the Great is actually appointing people, abbots and bishops, without telling anybody, simply just doing it because he is the Tsar. And given his behavior at the time, it's quite outrageous. So Adrian says that the court system in Russia is unacceptable, and what has to happen is that it needs to be reformed on the basis of being free and being completely neutral and independent. So Adrian, as a way to restrain Peter the Great, is advocating loudly a rule of law. And the monarchy is only justified if it follows the law, and the law is defined by the canon law of the church on the one hand and the traditional accretion of case law from Kievan Rus to today. And that's his basic political and social point of view. He dies 1700, a broken man. He knew what was happening. He knew that the church was in a lot of trouble and that Peter the Great was a mental case. He commented pretty regularly that he was powerless, He commented that Western European usury was invading Russia en masse. He believed that Russian culture was being threatened. He believed that the tradition of the agrarian commune was in trouble. And Adrian was smart enough to realize that the more westernized the country, the more powerful the nobility. And one of the great evils of Russian history is that after the life of Patriarch Adrian, as the upper nobility became more and more westernized, began speaking French, began traveling to Western Europe, they come back and begin demanding a Western life of luxury, which really means in practice that they press their peasants harder and harder. Serfdom had been a tolerable institution up until Peter the Great. Everyone had their place and had a specific sort of service. The nobles were often no wealthier than the average peasant family, and they had more responsibility since they were always away at work in Moscow, usually in military or bureaucratic capacity. Everyone served. But now, we're reaching a point where very soon the nobility will be freed from state service and the bureaucracy will become professional. This is a problem, because now the more that your average noble man is exposed to the luxuries and the luxurious lifestyle of the sort of the proto-capitalist and noble of Western Europe, the more he wants. It's a kind of a common Slavophile idea that the nobles prior to Patriarch Adrian were relatively simple and essentially middle class. That's going to change. The nobility is going to develop this Western corporate identity, and what it really means is that serfdom will become more and more like slavery in the 18th century. It's no accident that the rebellion of Pugachev under Catherine the Great, which took all of southern Russia and brought it under Cossack control, where the old belief was reinstated and foreigners were kicked out, and they developed some sort of a communal anarchism. The old believers were generally communalist anarchists in how they organized their life, but that was also deriving from the Kruk, or the Cossack Circle, as a form of representative government at the local level. And so the rebellion of Pugachev under Catherine the Great shows just how angry the average peasant was against this intensification of serfdom, the eliminating of Cossack liberties under Catherine the Great, the secularization of church property, and the continued development of Western capitalism and usury in Russia. And what all of this means is increasing slavery for the average peasant. Serfdom was tolerable prior to Adrian, but once Peter the Great centralized authority and brought Western ideas into Russia, suddenly the nobles want a lot more. They want to be like their Western European counterparts. They want to be capitalist millionaires. But of course, there is no free market since this is a communal system. They try to create that by, or imitate that by, squeezing their peasants more than before. Adrian struggled with despair and depression, because all of this he saw coming. He saw himself helpless. He saw Peter torturing to death thousands of his political opponents, in some cases personally. Peter kills his own son. You know, Ivan the Terrible gets this bad reputation, but Peter was far more bloody. At least you could defend Ivan the Terrible by saying that he was destroying the noble oligarchy. And that's why he's generally popular in the peasant folk songs of Russia. Peter the Great is doing this for the aggrandizement of himself, the state, and a handful of powerful nobles that Peter has promoted. A very different world. And as Adrian gets older, he begins to go into a depression. He thinks that it's over. And although he wrote quite a bit against the old believers and that older traditionalist orthodoxy, he began to share their point of view that things are coming to an end in Russia. Russian society is divided. Adrian sees that the ancient Orthodox tradition is in trouble. He is, although a powerful personality and an intelligent man, is powerless next to Peter the Great. priests need to be close to their families. Bishops need to stay in their sees for their whole lives, unlike what had happened and what had developed in Russia, where these bishops were sent from place to place, which is itself against the canons. He hated tobacco, and a lot of the Western traditions that were coming in, the Russians have no history of smoking, but that became a badge of being a Westernizer, spending a fortune in importing tobacco from Central Europe. And he said how disgusting this is. Whoever came up with this insanity of lighting up this leaf and inhaling it? It makes no sense to him. This is some of the stuff that's happening. Alcoholism is becoming a problem, as Ukrainian vodka, which is better than Russian vodka, is flooding the market. For him, church and state were meant to be cooperative in maintaining and enforcing the moral code of the canons, and yet he sees Peter the Great subverting it. He does believe the church is superior to the state, but it's all about conduct in his mind. He fought Western dress. He fought Western capitalism. He fought everything that was coming out of the Enlightenment at the time, which was not Western, but in fact a rejection of the Western Platonic and Gothic mentality. The fact is that the banker's alchemy was beginning to take over in elite circles, and this is what Westernization meant to Adrian. The development of this kind of pseudoscience, which justifies the gathering of wealth in an oligarchy. The Russian men began to shave. They began to wear Western suits. This was something that he thought was a corrosive entity and wanted to see it destroyed. The nobles, the more Western they became, the more like oligarchs they became. The more like oligarchs they became, the more they not only abused their peasants, but began to see themselves as a different group of people. Cosmopolitan, speaking French, living in St. Petersburg, which is a European city, Moscow is an Asian city, and living a very different life that is not only non-Orthodox, but anti-Orthodox. We study these last two patriarchs because we see Adrian dying a broken man. Russia is going through a violent revolution that may not have reached the level of systemic violence of the Bolsheviks, but served as a precursor to what later on would be the Bolshevik Revolution. That's my presentation for tonight. I think this deserves to be talked about. Most of my information comes from Russian language publications. There's very little on these two men in English, so I think I can contribute a little bit that way. And I appreciate you guys listening to me. I ask again for your generosity. I need your donations for continued study and travel. And I do not put any donation money to anything but things either for the church here or for my scholarship. And that money doesn't go to anywhere else. And you have my word on that. So I ask for your generosity as much as I hate asking for money. And I appreciate your support and I appreciate your listening. Thanks and good night.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned into Radio Area.